Hello and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Divide, our broadcast on Cyprus. My name is Hubert Faustmann. I'm the director of the office of the Friedrich Ebert Foundation here in Nicosia. Today's podcast is a joint podcast with the peace and security project in Beirut, a project to which the office in Nicosia has partially become part of. We remain part of Athens, but we also now work with the peace and security project in Beirut. So in that capacity, we are hosting it, and we are co-hosting it with Diplomats, which is a policy group working to improve relations between countries of the Mediterranean originating from the Mediterranean. The topic of our podcast is leveraging the energy factor to support peacemaking in Cyprus. And before I introduce my distinguished guests, a bit of background to it, inspired by a deal between Lebanon and Israel, which delineated the exclusive economic zones, we thought, okay, this might have spillover effects that could be used in Cyprus. And our guest is Professor Ahmet Sözen. He's chair at the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the Eastern Mediterranean University in the North. He's also the director of the think tank or Cyprus Policy Center. He was also a member of the negotiation team on the Turkish Cypriot side in their attempts to solve the Cyprus problem. He's a member of Diplomats, and he co-edited a report entitled Conflict Resolution in the Mediterranean, Energy as a Potential Game Changer. So he's one of the editors, but he's also one author of a chapter that deals specifically with Cyprus and that gives our podcast the title, Leveraging the Energy Factor to Support Peacemaking in Cyprus. But it's not just the two of us. I have another dear guest, and it's Laurie Hatayan, who's an energy policy and geopolitical expert. She's from Lebanon, and that helps because she is one of the leading experts on the Israeli-Lebanese agreement. And in order to understand to what extent that could be useful for Cyprus, I think it's extremely helpful to get a very good idea of what this deal is about. And Laurie will enlighten us on this topic. She's the Middle East and North African director at the Natural Resource Governance Institute. And she is a veteran of recording podcasts. She was the host of the Energy Espresso podcast and is now involved in a new podcast series whose name elopes me. So a very warm welcome, Ahmet. A very warm welcome, Laurie.
Thank you for having me, Hubert. Always a pleasure.
Same here.
Laurie, let's start with you. So how could you explain to somebody who's not that familiar with the topic the deal between Israel and Lebanon and why this deal is such a big deal?
So thank you, Hubert, for having me. It's always a pleasure to share a panel with Ahmet and to discuss Eastern Mediterranean issues from politics to energy. So my pleasure to be here again. Thank you for inviting me. So let me say that Lebanon-Israel signed the deal, the maritime border deal, in October 2022. And this was a dispute that lasted for 10 years, so a decade. And everybody was asking, so what's the recipe for success? So let me give you my interpretation of that recipe, and it has six ingredients, if you want, or 6 points. So one is that it was a very clear agenda. Both parties were there to solve one issue only, which was the maritime issue. As you know, Lebanon, Israel, they have so many issues, and they are two countries that don't recognize each other. They have, as I said, years of grievance, but they decided to enter into these negotiations to solve only one issue, which is the maritime issue. So that's one recipe for one point, one ingredient for the success. Second, that it was a very clear process. The U.S. was to mediate, and the U.S. mediation was both technical and political. It started as technical, and then when it felt that it was ripe, the politics entered, and then the shuttle diplomacy worked. And that is because the mediator in the second level had the leverage and the ears of the president of the U.S. So that as well is important to push for deals to happen. The third point, or the third ingredient, if you want, is the appetite to engage. So both parties, the Lebanese and the Israelis, wanted to engage into these negotiations regardless of their incentives. Definitely they had different incentives why they entered. But at the same time, that engagement and that appetite for engagement made it that they were willing to come to a solution. So that's my third ingredient. The fourth ingredient, it's like the needs. So Israelis had one need, the Lebanese had a different need. So it was easy when it was understood for the mediator to come up with a solution. Definitely the priority for the Israelis was the security angle of this deal and the importance security-wise. And that's why we saw the military supporting the deal at the end when there were like political divisions inside Israel. So, and that made it as well, like gutting the ownership inside the country and the support. For Lebanon, it was an economic need more than anything else. So when the mediator understood that one is economic and the other is security, put them together, it was a deal that met both needs. And that's very important. I guess the fifth ingredient for me was like very important. It's what are the basis of these negotiations and this deal, not negotiation, the deal. So yes, UNCLOS was the start because there was already a line that was disagreed between Israel and Lebanon, and that is what created the whole dispute. But at the end, the final outcome was not based on the legal documents and what UNCLOS says or what this legal document says or not. It was a line, if you want, like the line in the sand that we talk about for the Middle East and how the Middle East came to come, to be divided between superpowers. That line in the water was a political line, a line that both Lebanon and Israel knew that didn't have a legal base, but it was something that both countries were okay with. And that is important as well to understand. That was the breakthrough that, yes, we understand the legal parameters, but we want to do with the possible. And even the mediator, Amos Hochstein, said it live on TV. He said, yes, we understand the legalities. Yes, we understand that you will go to fight for your legal right. But what is possible and what you can get is more important to make this deal happen. So, and this is what happened. So it's important to understand this is a political line agreed upon by both countries. Very important point. And my last point and my last ingredient for success, it's the alignment of the regional powers that have an influence, at least in Lebanon, that agreed on the deal. And I say this because for the Cyprus case, we all know that Turkey has an influence, Greece has an influence. So for us in the Lebanon-Israel case, if Iran wasn't aligned and didn't see that it's agenda aligned with a deal to happen between Lebanon and Israel, maybe this agreement wouldn't have come to exist. Because as you know, one element, the strong element that could have opposed and spoiled the agreement is Hezbollah. And Hezbollah's agenda is very closely linked to the regional agenda of Iran. So if Iran was not on board as well, in one way or another, this deal couldn't have happened. So again, the sixth point is about like, again, the regional influence and how to tackle the regional influence. So all of these points are my interpretation for the success of the outcome, or if you want, a positive outcome of the negotiation and the mediation, actually mediation that the U.S. had undertaken that started in October 2020 and ended with a successful outcome in October 2022. So 2 years.
Thank you so much, Lori. Now that we have the Lebanon-Israeli story straight, let's come to the Cyprus story. Ahmed, for somebody who's not a Cyprus problem buff, can you just briefly outline the context in which such a deal would have to take place, and then we go into the specifics?
Yeah, the Cyprus issue, which has been dominating the international community's agenda since the 1950s, is a protracted conflict. Since the 70s, as you know, after the war in Cyprus, 1974 war, there are two high-level agreements in the 70s, 77 Makarios Denktash and 79 Denktash Kyprianou, which set the stage for all the other negotiations that would take place afterwards, where at least on paper, two sides agreed that the future solution of Cyprus should be based on creation of a federal state. It would be bi-communal with regard to constitutional aspects, and it would be bi-zonal with regard to territorial aspects. And since the late 70s, all the negotiations that took place were based on those parameters, finding a solution based on a bi-zonal, bi-communal federation. Now, the last 2 decades, we have seen a couple of very important turning points in Cyprus. Of course, the inclusion of Cyprus to EU is one of those cases where the acquis communautaire, meaning the EU laws, are only used in the southern part of Cyprus, which is known by the international community as the Republic of Cyprus, where the EU laws are suspended until a solution in the northern part of Cyprus. The 2004 UN settlement agreement, which is also known as the Annan Plan, which was put to simultaneous separate referendums on the 24th of April 2004, almost 20 years ago, is another major turning point in Cyprus. We know the results. While the agreement was supported by 65% of Turkish Cypriots, it was rejected by 76% of Greek Cypriots in the referendum. So, unfortunately, without two yeses, the very first and the last comprehensive solution plan became null and void, and it was a missed opportunity. Of course, since then, since the failure of the Annan Plan, intercommunal negotiations continued on and off to a point where in 2016, the two sides agreed on some of the dossiers, some of the issues of Cyprus problem. At least they came to some convergences on areas of governance and power sharing, economic issues, EU-related issues, property, territory, and so forth. And the Cyprus negotiations transitioned to an international Cyprus conference that started in 2016 in Geneva with the inclusion of the three guarantors, Turkey, Greece, and United Kingdom, as well as EU as an observer. Now, there was a series of negotiations or series of the continuation of the Cyprus International Conference to Mont Pelerin, where the security-related issues were discussed. And then finally, as we all know very well, the summer of 2017, the conference took place in Crans-Montana, Switzerland. And it was all the parties were there for about 10 days. But unfortunately, the conference collapsed without any breakthrough. And since then, there has been a debate whether the collapse of Crans-Montana was a watershed, or is it simply a bump in the road where the pieces will be picked up again and will resume. Unfortunately, since then, it's been almost 6 years, we do not have a formal negotiation process in Cyprus, meaning that the two sides have not negotiated on a formal manner. The UN conducted or hosted two what they call informal meetings, five-partite meetings, with the inclusion of the representatives of the three guarantor powers, but a lot was remained to the election season, which we started in Cyprus with 2020 with the election of a Turkish Cypriot leader, somebody who was not really interested in a federal solution, Mr. Ersin Tatar. And finally, a few months ago, with the election of Nikos Christodoulidis in the Greek Cypriot side in the Republic of Cyprus. Again, somebody who is not very keen on a federal solution and who was basically supported by traditional no-sayers in the Greek Cypriot community, mostly nationalists. Then, of course, we have the election season in Turkey, which just ended. Now, of course, the question is, after this election season, let's say in the fall, is there any possibility that all the sides will go back to the negotiation table based on the high-level agreement parameters? Or is it ancient history? Because since 2020, and especially after the end of the collapse of the Crown Montana, the Turkish side, at least in discourse, they are suggesting that federal solution is dead and buried. The only way that the Turkish side goes back to the negotiation table is the prerequisite is that the sovereign equality of the two sides should be acknowledged by the UN and by the Greek Cypriot side. Now, again, is this a radical departure from traditional Turkish foreign policy on Cyprus, or is it a strategic move by Turkey with the tactical part where there is a nice saying in Turkish, it's like showing the death and getting the other side to agree on malaria. The death being two states and malaria being a bizonal, bicommunal federation based on political equality of the two communities. Now, I think that this is where we are. And during the summer, as you know, the diplomatic community goes to some sort of hibernation. So we don't expect much of any initiative. But my hunch and my evaluation tell me that in the fall of 2023, there will be some attempts to initiate a negotiation process in Cyprus. But we'll see where it goes. So I'll stop here and then we can maybe open this up.
Yeah, I think now we should focus on energy in this context. So what role do energy, probably means hydrocarbons, but not just hydrocarbons, as we will see in a minute, but they're part of the problem. Very briefly, maybe the background, yeah. And then to what extent, why then could the Israel-Lebanese deal be of help within this sub-aspect of the Cyprus problem?
Thank you, Hubert. I think you're right on the target at this point. Look, the discovery of hydrocarbons in the Eastern Mediterranean of the waters of Cyprus created a euphoria at the beginning, and there were a lot of debates among scholars, think tankers, policymakers, and all that, that will the discovery of these resources in fact help motivate the solution of the Cyprus problem. But unfortunately, it just operated just the opposite. Because unfortunately, energy issues were not picked up in the intercommunal negotiations. They were not part of the negotiations. It was basically treated as an issue of sovereignty. For example, the Greek Cypriot leadership was saying that, yeah, we agree that Turkish Cypriots also have their shares in all the resources, natural resources, but nonetheless, this is an issue of the sovereign government of the Republic of Cyprus, so we don't negotiate this in the formal negotiations. That was a missed opportunity. Because at the beginning, there, you know, the energy prices were in an extent where it would have been commercialable to dig it out and use it either domestically and maybe also export it. if there were cooperation between the two sides. But unfortunately, we missed that train. And later, as you know, the prices of natural gas dropped to a point where digging out the gas off the waters of Cyprus was not really seen commercially. Nowadays, with the invasion of Russian invasion of Ukraine and the subsequent energy crisis and the skyrocketing of the energy prices, in fact, creates a new opportunity. Whether we will be able to utilize it this time is a different question, of course, but it does pose a new opportunity, and in this policy report where I authored the Cyprus chapter, there I propose that there are ways to engage the two sides by the inclusion of energy to contribute to the peace building, where I say the recommendation is based on two layers. Layer one is what I call engagement without recognition. And layer two is bringing the energy in, inspired by, remember in political science, we had Theda Scotchpole, who wrote about bringing the state in, famous book. I sort of got inspired from it, and I call it bringing the energy issue in. Now, engagement without recognition is basically what I propose is the Greek and Turkish Cypriot sides should engage with one another without recognizing one another. Or even Turkey and the Greek Cypriot side, the Republic of Cyprus, should be engaged in this. They have to be able to deal with certain issues through mediation, through many mechanisms. And I think that we have precedent in Cyprus, for example, when there was an explosion in Mari, where one-third of the power plant was lost. The Greek Cypriot side bought electricity from the north, from the Turkish Cypriot side. And that wouldn't mean recognition of the TRNC or the pseudo-state, as the Greek Cypriot leadership called it. They did it via the two chambers of commerce. So it showed us that even if the two sides don't recognize one another, if there is a will and there is a way. And of course, as Laurie, my good friend, also talked about, I value this Israeli-Lebanese deal a lot, because that is also a prime example which shows us that here you have two countries who do not recognize one another. They are at war with one another, but nonetheless, through creative conflict resolution mechanisms, it was possible to come up with an agreement on delineating the maritime borders between the two countries. So that is possible also in Cyprus, on one level, to get the Greek Cypriot side and Turkey to start talking about the future delineation between the island and Turkey. On the other level, bringing the Greek and Turkish Cypriots to deal and to discuss energy issues, and not just natural gas, but also future of how to prepare Cyprus for renewable energy. Also getting those. So in the second layer in Cyprus, where I talk about bringing the energy in, I talk about, for example, the Greek and Turkish Cypriot sides establishing an institution on renewable energy. I'm talking about two sides adopting EU and UN-related benchmarks on future energy and whatnot. So the sky is the limit there. And I think that as a peace building expert, it gives me a lot of sadness to say this, but I'm going to say it. The war in Ukraine, despite all the horrors and despite all the sufferings of the Ukrainians, I do acknowledge those. But at the same time, this war also created a new opportunity for Cyprus, as well as for solving other problems in the Eastern Mediterranean, the right, let's say, atmosphere.
I think that brings us in an interesting direction. I mean, let's talk about the geopolitics. You mentioned this, and Laurie was very big on how, let's say, the external players and potential spoilers were aligned. What's your assessment about the geopolitical situation? Are the stars aligned for such a kind of deal in Cyprus? And Laurie, please feel free to add from your geopolitical expertise there as well.
Look, Hubert, I think that this is a very complicated or a very sophisticated alignment that are taking place. I mean, on the one hand, for example, you see U.S. involvement with the Israeli-Lebanese deal. And but at the same time, a lot of people are talking about U.S. sort of leaving this region, departing from this region. And then finally, the last a few weeks ago, we saw China playing an important role in bringing Saudi Arabia and Iran together, which is making the Americans nervous. And according to some people, that that the Americans are reevaluating their decision of sort of departing this region. And I don't think that they will depart this region. But in any case, both the Americans or the Western Alliance in general, the Americans as well as the EU, can play important role in initiating certain attempts to solve some of the issues in the region. Turkey's normalization with Israel and Egypt, maybe those countries can also play a productive role, a constructive role of bringing Turkey, which is the elephant in the room, in fact, back and integrate Turkey to the regional structure, where Turkey was, due to various different reasons, of course, due to its own also faulty foreign policy since 2012 or whatnot, since the beginning of the Arab Spring, that there was a bloc formed in front of Turkey, an opposition, Republic of Cyprus, Greece, Israel, Egypt, but that is also changing. So we should be careful, but at the same time, we should be able to utilize these new power configurations towards solving the problems in the region.
If
Laurie, you want to add?
So, yeah, let me come in and compliment what Ahmed is saying. So basically, if you want to take the pre-Russia-Ukraine war, the situation in the Eastern Mediterranean was that Egypt wanted to had the aspirations to become the energy hub for the region. Turkey had the same aspirations. The main players of the region, Israel, Greece, and Cyprus, decided to align with Egypt and to empower the role of Egypt as a hub because of technical and political reasons, but at the same time, and that created the East Med Gas Forum. That kind of didn't please a lot Turkey, and we know what happened, the reactions that Turkey had taken from blocking some exploration in the region, from going and doing the deal with Libya to block any kind of potential possibilities for the East Med Gas Forum to be functional. Anyway, so now the situation post Ukraine Russia, if you want, Russia is playing on that division, if you want, and it had put on the table for Turkey to make Turkey the hub for the region, at least to say that we are ready to put more effort, put more gas into the existing infrastructure for Turkey to become a hub. So in this situation where we are in now, you have so regardless if that will become reality or not, but what is happening is like We are never discussing in the region the possibility of really building these pipelines, possible pipelines to Turkey. It was attempted in 2016, I think, by the Israelis, and then it didn't work for different reasons, politics, etc. And so basically, the idea is, if we want to take politics into consideration, but at the same time, the prosperity of the region, should you contemplate like creating that pipeline from the Eastern Mediterranean through Egypt, through Cyprus, going into Turkey, and then instead of Turkey becoming an ally to Russia, becomes more an ally to the companies that are mostly European and American companies in the Eastern Mediterranean. If you want to just switch on your geopolitical hat and not the technical hat, so should you consider that? Should you put that on the table as a government, as different governments in the region, as the U.S. saying that we want to bar the Russian from playing that card? Why don't we contemplate this? And it's very interesting today because Chevron, being the U.S., one of the big U.S. major companies, Chevron is homage, again, if you want, on the Cypriot Aphrodite case. So they have submitted their plans. And it's interesting to see what kind of development plans they have in mind for Aphrodite. Because once we understand what their marketing plan is, then we can understand how they're seeing this gas in the Eastern Mediterranean going to be getting out of the region. Is it the FLNG? Again, the FLNG, definitely it will be like escaping all problems, just putting a floating liquefied natural gas unit and then putting all the gas and processing it and selling it without any of the political problems. But definitely it's important to understand the role of IOCs and to understand how to use the IOCs to help, not in economic, but in the economic aspect, but also in some of the political issues. The same as it happened in the Lebanon case. If in Lebanon-Israel case, if Total didn't agree on some of the conditions that were being put, the deal maybe wouldn't have happened. Because at the end of the day, they said, if there is a common reservoir between Lebanon and Israel, so the part that is in the Israeli side should be compensated by Total. And it shouldn't be any direct conversations between the Lebanese and the Israelis on that part that is on the Israeli side. If Total had said, no, this is not something that I would like to do, I don't want to do that, etc., then maybe the deal wouldn't have happened. So there is an important role for the IOCs as well in the region, because at the end of the day, no one like Israel, Cyprus, Lebanon, they don't have national oil companies that would dictate direction. We are at the mercy of the IOCs, the international oil companies. If they decide to pursue the exploration, we can have exploration. If they don't decide to pursue exploration, we don't have anything. We don't have the leverage. We don't have the power to do that. On the contrary, for instance, Turkey, because they have their national company and because there is a policy, very strict policy, that they want to become independent from importing all of their needs. So they're pushing their company to really go and exploit and find gas. And they were successful in the Black Sea. They were successful in other places when it comes to oil. For us in the region, most of us, we are reliant on IOCs. So for that, you need to be as flexible as you can, as governments as well, to make it as easy as possible for the companies to exploit and get this gas flowing and going. If you have all these political problems among the countries, the IOCs will come drill a well, say, yeah, you know what, but how will I send this gas to where if you don't talk to your neighbors, if you don't want me to put the pipeline, which is the most economic, but because you don't like the government there. So then they will either leave or whatever solution they can come up maybe will not be in favor of the governments of the region. So that's important as well, to merge between the politics, geopolitics, and the economic, and how IOCs think.
Thank you, Nori. Ahmed, let's assume there is a deal between the conflicting sides in Cyprus to come at the core of your paper so that energy could be leveraged to support the peacemaking process. What possibilities would this open up let's say, in the core question of energy, and to what extent it fits into the Green Deal context of the European Union, if you can elaborate on this. And then maybe on the next level, what would be the spillover to attempts to solve the Cyprus problem if such a deal could be achieved?
That's a great question, Hubert. Look, the way I look at it, now we do not have the internal dynamics are not healthy on both sides. As you know, we have two nationalist sort of leadership where it is also the lack of any cooperation between the two sides is also poisoning the atmosphere, is poisoning the relations between the two communities, or it's not really helping at all. So, first of all, a kind of cooperation between the two communities, between the leaderships of the two communities, will soften the atmosphere, will give more hope to average people where the last 6 years, lack of any formal negotiations has really poisoned the atmosphere. But of course, you know, let me also say this, that I do not believe that internal dynamics is enough in solving the Cyprus problem. So definitely a kind of cooperation that starts between the two communities with joint, let's say, institutions or with joint committees who would work on energy-related issues, including how the whole island can transition to renewables in the future, how we can use solar or wind power and utilize, for example, the buffer zone in doing that and whatnot. This will create new opportunities and new jobs that would make the very lives, everyday lives of Greek and Turkish Cypriots more positive. It will touch the very lives of Greek and Turkish Cypriots in a positive way. So it will change the atmosphere dramatically, where bottom up there can be more pressure coming from the civil society and whatnot on the leaders to actually take steps, not just in energy, but also as a spillover effect in other areas. Now, if we combine this, that's the missing link, what I said with the internal dynamics is not enough. If we can combine this with the push or with the encouragement coming from the three guarantors and also from the regional level, coming from other neighbors, other littoral states, that can play the trick of bringing a comprehensive solution to the Cyprus problem. So we need engagement in all different levels, not just local, but also on the levels of the guarantors, as well as on the level of regional dynamics, where you have also other littoral states, as well as great powers to play a constructive role, just like the Americans played in the Israeli-Lebanese deal. Maybe Germany. Maybe Norway, maybe Switzerland, I don't know. But some other third parties, not just states, but also what Laurie mentioned, international gas oil companies can play a constructive role. So we have to be open-minded and open to trying novel ways of conflict resolution, and also be aware of the potential spoilers. And unfortunately, whether we like it or not, the current Russia, Putin's Russia, is also a potential spillover, a spoiler in the region. And we have to also keep an eye on that. Maybe in the future, if the regime changes, it can be a European actor, maybe. But currently, that's not the case. Now, this is all about, this is what we tried to do in the publication for the diplomats, meaning looking at different conflicts in the Mediterranean region and trying to see how creative conflict resolution mechanisms with the inclusion of the energy dynamic or the energy dimension, we can come up with some policy recommendations for the solution of the Mediterranean-related conflicts.
Laurie, just hit me. Were there any positive spillover effects from the Israeli-Lebanese deal? Is it a one-off? Or did it start changing things in the relations between the two or other players in the region? Or it's too early to tell, or nothing happened?
Look, it was very clear for the Lebanese, at least the Lebanese side, that this is just about the maritime border and it has nothing to do with other issues, because people were talking about normalization, people were talking about this is the start of a peace process between the countries, etc. So for today, it was very clear. They went in to solve an issue, they solved the issue, and then life continues. On the Lebanese side, they got what they want, and the hydrocarbon activities were relaunched, and Total had committed to do the drilling in Block 9, which was like the block that had issues, like the delimitation issues. And then by September, the drilling will happen, and then we'll know the results. Either there is no gas, or there is gas with quantities that are not possible to be developed, or there will be gas that will be developed and produced. In that case, either the whole of the gas is in the Lebanese territories, so then life goes on between Lebanon and the companies. In case it is a common reservoir, then Total has to step in to find a financial agreement with Israel, so that Lebanon can produce the gas. And from there, we will start thinking about, like, okay, where this gas is going to go internally and to export, how are we going to export? And then we will be hit by all the complexities about the region. So wherever you go, you hit yourself with the politics of the region. That's why I think, like, we can use the energy to solve the politics. I agree with Ahmad that energy could play that role, because if everybody is eager to use their gas and then they're hitting the wall of politics, so then definitely you need to do something. Or else you will say that, you know, yes, we have gas, we're keeping it in the ground or in the waters because we cannot agree on the politics. Or, as again, for instance, one idea for Lebanon that we are thinking now, like, a scenario, let's say, it's in case Total comes in and says, you know what? Yes, I can get that gas out, but I need to use the common infrastructure that already exists in the region. And that is part of using the Karish infrastructure, which is on the Israeli side. So what will Lebanon do? Will it again be very flexible and very pragmatic and say, you know what, this is the Total share, so they can do whatever they want as long as they give us our share. So let them go and hook themselves to the energy and infrastructure, for instance. So are they going to be that practical or not? Until now, in the oil and gas sector, Lebanon has been very pragmatic and very pragmatic with an entity that is Hezbollah that says that it wants to see the end of Israel. So look to that pragmatism because of energy. So I think, like, this is something that Ahmad is trying to hit on all the time. Look at the Lebanon-Israel case, pragmatism at its best, even though, like, two entities that hate each other, but they're able, like, to think about, like, to think together, if you want, kind of, to get what they want. So I will end on that note, I guess. And thank you, Hubert, for inviting me. Exciting talks.
I think it's a good final comment, Ahmed. I don't want to cut you short. Anything you want to add?
No, definitely. Maybe just the finishing sentences. I think that what we need in Cyprus, and I think maybe I can speak for the other conflicts too, to a certain extent, that we need to change the traditional or the accustomed discussion among the public and among the political elites, where they usually focus on very nationalistic narratives. I think that the new narrative should be to emphasize that the world is changing, and it is definitely changing. There is a huge power shift in the new power configurations on the global level. We see this relative rise of China, maybe less relative rise of Russia and maybe relative decline of the United States. And on the regional level, these are having also repercussions on the regional level. And in this region, in the Eastern Mediterranean in general, we also see dramatic power shifts taking place. These are also times where there are new opportunities. And the idea is to look at the new realities in such a way that we should see the opportunities, and we should emphasize in the public debate that if we want to grab and exploit these new opportunities, we need more cooperation. And when we should have more cooperation, we shouldn't have very narrow-minded state-to-state kind of Westphalian, let's say, attitude, but we should be open-minded to include both states as well as non-state actors in a creative manner, in a more all-inclusive peace-designing manner.
Thank you very much, Ahmet and Laurie. I mean, we are on the ground in a very desperate situation. If you live here in Cyprus, I've rarely been in a more pessimistic environment, in a more frustrated environment amongst those who are in favor of reunification and the solution of the Cyprus problem. So I think it's timely that you come in with some optimistic or constructive ideas that could turn this mood around and use the Israel-Lebanese progress to make progress here on the ground as well. So wonderful for both of you to be here. Thank you so much for your contribution. This was another episode of the podcast Beyond the Divide. You find it on our website, fascyprus.org. You find it on all podcast platforms there are. And a big thank you goes to our co-partner and co-host in this podcast, Diplomats, and the report, Conflict Resolution in the Mediterranean, Energy is a Potential Game Changer, can be found both on our website, but also on the website of the Diplomats, which is diplomats.org. So thank you for listening. Thank you, both of you. Until next time. Bye.